I could have danced all night and still have begged for more. I could have spread my wings and done a thousand things I've never done before. I'll never know.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, coming to you today from our downtown studios on Main Street in Logan in the Cache Valley Center for the Arts. We're going to preview the seasons for two great Utah arts organizations. Later in the program, we'll talk about Shakespeare with the general director and one of the actresses in Utah Shakespeare Festival. They're presenting Hamlet, Merry Wives of Windsor, Titus Andronicus, and Mary Stuart, among many others. We'll begin with Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Hey! Who was that guy?
Who's this guy?
The girls today in society go for classical poetry. To win their hearts, one must quote with ease Aeschylus and Euripides.
One must know Homer and believe me, Paul. Sophocles also sang the whole.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We are coming to you today from Main Street in Logan, our downtown studios in the Cache Valley Center for the Art. And we're going to brush up on our Shakespeare today all the way through the program. Second half of the program, we'll be talking with Scott Phillips, a director of the Utah Shakespeare Festival. We'll also be joined by one of the actresses, Sarah Griffin, who's Anne Page in Merry Wives of Windsor in the ensemble in Les Mis and Ophelia in Hamlet. But we begin with Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater. We're joined in our studios downtown in Logan by Michael Ballum, general director, founder of the opera. Welcome back.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
We appreciate you being with us. We're joined also by soprano Jessica Madoff, who is singing Marguerite and Faust.
Good morning.
And the director of My Fair Lady, Valerie Rochelle. Thanks.
Good morning.
For coming in. So, Michael, a great lineup as always. You have some opera with Faust and with Tosca, and then some musical theater. And I can't remember how long ago you actually made the change to the name of the company.
Well, we've always done musical theater and opera, but 2 years ago we determined that ought to be part of our title since that's what we do. And this is our 20th season, for which we're very grateful to be around and being able to produce these wonderful works.
And so My Fair Lady and Kiss Me, Kate.
Yes.
Which is basically Taming of the Shrew.
Yes, it is.
So let's begin with My Fair Lady. And I don't know, you come to something... Valerie Rochelle, something quite familiar to most people. Many people have seen the movie, for example. How do you come with fresh ideas with this?
The script is so beautiful that it really kind of speaks for itself. So I always start with the script, and then you basically take your cast and you work with what you have there in the room, and you collaborate together to make a beautiful piece of art.
Very good. And what's the process? You get here earlier than the singers?
I actually don't get here earlier, but I do start earlier over email and phone calls with the designers, talking about what we want to say with the piece, what we want the audience to leave the theater feeling and thinking, and then we go from there.
And Valerie brings a very special perspective because she's a performer herself, a wonderful singing actress, and a wonderful dancer. And this is a work that requires all three of those. So she brings something very special to it. Mm.
Let's hear a bit of music from this. Let's hear some more of I Could Have Danced All Night.
Bed, bed, I couldn't go to bed. My head's too light to try to sit it down. Sleep, sleep, I couldn't sleep tonight. Not for all the jewels in the crown. I could have danced all night. I could have danced all night and still have begged for more. I could have spread my
I'll never know what made it so exciting. Why all at once my heart took flight. I only know when he began to dance with me, I could have danced, danced, danced.
I think we're most of us are familiar with that. I don't know, Jessica, are you listening to that, wishing you were singing this?
A little bit, yeah. I want to do it all.
Yeah. You've got plenty going on this summer,
Jessica. That's true, a little demanding. So give us a little bit of the Pygmalion?
Yes, based on Pygmalion by George Bernard Shaw. And I think Lerner and Lowe did a very, very fantastic job of honoring the script and adding the songs that needed to be added to forward the action of the play rather than just singing a song to have a song there. All of the music is superbly placed and really follows exactly what emotions and what action the audience needs to understand to be involved with the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they do a great job. In fact, when I watch Pygmalion now, I'm wishing for the music.
Yes. That's... Isn't that right?
So I guess a testament to the success of Lerner and Lowe. It's just beautiful music all the way through it.
It was voted last year by the National Association of Musical Theater, the show with the most hits. Came from the golden age, 1956. It was a really wonderful age of the musical theater.
Why do you think that is? It's got all these hits in it, just a very rich vein that Lerner and Lowe were able to hit?
Yes, and the experience the two of them had since the late 40s coming together, and their lush orchestration, which we forget about because we don't get to hear that anymore. On Broadway, we hear 13 musicians, many of which are synthetic instruments, and to hear it here with that lush, wonderful orchestration with those beautiful strings, it's such a pleasure. It's a beautiful score.
I think the lead male role, with that range, was that written for Rex Harrison?
It's kind of that, it was to some degree. However, Kyle Fortmiller, who was playing the role, can sing beautifully and does sing beautifully. He's also in Faust and in Kiss Me, Kate. And it's wonderful to be able to hear going in and out of the speech patterns and into beautiful singing.
That was the question. You know, in this production, obviously, you have someone who has a broader range than Rex Harrison did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Puccini. And Tosca. It's always a good idea if you have a musical theater company to do some Puccini.
Yes, yes. Gotta have him here at least every other year.
What was it about Puccini? He just had a great theater sense?
He did have a wonderful theater sense. He was always going to the theater. In fact, he was in Paris premiering La Bohème when he went to the theater and saw Sarah Bernhardt play Tosca. And he was so taken by it, especially the moment when she sees the knife on the table. He went back to his hotel room and began to write the opera from that point backwards, because he could sense that the high drama of Sardou's play would lend itself to his passionate understanding of theatrical music. I don't know that it gets better than Tosca.
This was fairly shocking.
Very shocking.
One of the critics called it a shabby little shocker.
That's right, one of them did. I'll bet he regrets that wherever he
is
at this point. Because it has become one of the five most performed operas of history, and rightly so.
This is very gripping. I've prepared two from this piece, just so many great numbers. One is the end of Act One. And
Te Deum.
This really delineates the character of Scarpia. Tell us a bit about Scarpia.
Well, he's a very wicked man, and this is based upon poetic license to history. But there he is in the church of San Andrea, and the congregation is singing the Te Deum, a wonderfully righteous piece of music, and he is being very secular, let's just say. He's dreaming about having Tosca for himself, so you have this evil next to this great righteous moment. Music can do that. Straight theater would have a hard time suspending that moment. Music stops the clock. And so at this moment we hear his dark side and the wonderful light side of the people in the church.
And in fact, he says, Tosca, you make me forget God.
Yes, you know, make me forget God.
Which I don't know if he ever remembered God, but you know, he's that kind of a character. So let's hear this couple of minutes. This is the finale from Act One and the chorus. And I believe in this recording it's Tito Gobbi. There's the end of Act One. That's if that doesn't make you want to go.
Yeah, it's glorious, absolutely glorious moment. I can't think of any other piece of music that 5 minutes is as powerful as that.
And it illustrates Puccini's great skills as an orchestrator.
Yes,
it's just
beautiful.
The brass beautiful. There and powerful moment. I wonder, Jessica, is this a role you've sung or would like to sing? Or?
Someday.
Yeah.
Maybe.
It's enough to make me want to take estrogen.
Yeah.
I mean, Tosca must be so thrilling to be able to play.
Yeah, I imagine. Michael, have you sung Cavaradossi?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, so is that bringing back memories?
Oh, yes, that? But I'm glad it's Jonathan up there.
Yes.
I can enjoy sitting in the audience. It is a sublime cast.
Yeah. Let's hear another piece of music from Tosca. This is now Act 3, and it's Cavaradossi's Aria. And this is a glorious, just a beautiful, Puccini could spin out melodies, at will. And this is Cavaradossi remembering happier days with Tosca. He's about to be executed, he's in prison, and he sings, his memories, the door to the gate opened, her foot on the path, she falls into my arms, and then he sings, I've never loved life more than this moment. Let's hear this. This is Franco Corelli. Wow.
If I believed in reincarnation, I would want to come back as Franco Corelli.
Yes, definitely. Even with the stage fright.
Yes, he was an interesting character. And we're having a class at part of our academy this summer where we're going to talk about our experiences with Mr. Corelli. Peggy Tuller worked for the Metropolitan Opera for many years, and she was assigned to be his babysitter, sort of. It's going to be a very interesting class.
So he was maybe sort of the stereotypical high-strung tenor?
Very, very high-strung, and we have lots of wonderful stories about him. Maybe that's why his performances were so gripping, because he was frightened to death in spite of that glorious instrument.
That voice, why would you be afraid? Yeah, but
I'll give you the answer. Loretta Corelli.
Okay.
His wife was very instrumental in causing his fear.
Oh.
She stood in the wings and timed his high notes and criticized him when he came off the stage. She was one interesting character.
Wow, interesting. So that'll be a part of the season here. Interesting. I wonder, I was thinking if I were the tenor here in the company about to go on, would I cue up Corelli? Would that be intimidating to me? Or could I learn something?
I can't speak for Jonathan, but I listened to Mr. Corelli many, many times because he had a vocal technique that could do astonishing things. The way he spins off of that A, nobody has ever been able to do it like he did it. He had some secret. Maybe Loretta gave it to him. I don't know. But I don't know if Jonathan does. Jonathan brings the most connected performance I think I've ever seen. When he sings E luce van le stelle, it's different than what Corelli did, but it's so internalized. You feel the pain. E muoio disperata, I'm dying in desperation. It's heartrending the way Jonathan sings it. It's extraordinary.
I'm wondering, Jessica Madoff, is that, you know, if you get ready for the role of Marguerite, do you listen to some great Marguerites? Is that intimidating? What do you do?
This is my first time singing this role, so when I began learning it, I started from scratch with myself and a pianist. And like Valerie said, anytime you start a new project, you go to the words, you go to the script. So I went to the libretto and learned the language and learned it as me, learned it for myself. And then once I had made my own ideas and my own musical and dramatic choices, then I listened to other people and compare and contrast and definitely learn from other people's interpretations. But I find that as a theatrical beast, it's my most favorite part of the process is finding where it is inside of me first. So,
and Valerie, is that what you would? Is that your process too? You try to go straight to the script first, and then go to other things.
Yes, because there's so much out there now on the internet. You can look up, you know, any number of from any musical, really, or opera, or and then see clips on YouTube or from high school productions. So there's so much out there to look at. It's distracting in a way.
Yeah.
So I start with the score and the script first. And then when you have formed your own ideas, it's kind of nice to see the other information that's out there, you know, as research. But it's kind of hard to look at it first because then you feel like you're going to be stealing someone else's art.
Yeah. And I find that in opera, that's also an interesting thing to consider, that we are so steeped in tradition as a genre that there are certain things that are expected that aren't necessarily written.
Correct.
You know, there's high notes that are interpolated that Gounod didn't write, but some wonderful woman who had that facility 100 years ago did, and so now everybody does
making life miserable for everyone.
Exactly.
Should come
so after. It's an interesting genre in that we have to kind of honor the past because it's so steeped in tradition, but also find for ourselves what works in this day. Yeah. And I think that's what keeps the tradition alive. It's because we all come to the table with our own ideas and we have brilliant work to work with, but
definitely
it's an interesting thing.
Valerie, I wonder, when you have your conception of the work that you've worked out, that maybe go out and do some other research, when your singers or actors come in, they probably have some ideas as well. How do you mesh all that?
Rehearsal.
Okay.
I mean, the reason why I'm a director is because I love rehearsals. I love working moment to moment with actors and singers, and I love to find what works best for the show that we are doing, because no matter how hard we try, Julie Andrews is not here to play the role. So I have to take my Eliza and use all the talents that she has and help find what works best, that works for the script, the score, and our cast. And that's my favorite part of the process.
And Valerie is very special in that regard, because she comes with an idea of what it should be, but she also looks to the actors. And when she sees something that they have come up with, an idea, when it's a good one, she will pull that out. Give me more of that. That's right. Which it makes her very special.
If you just joined us, we are in our downtown studios in the Cache Valley Center for the Arts on Main Street in Logan. And we are previewing the seasons for two great Utah arts organizations. Coming up in the next half of the program, we'll be previewing the season for Utah Shakespeare Festival with their general director, Scott Phillips. We'll also be talking with one of the actresses, Sarah Griffin. And right now we're talking with Jessica Madoff, who's singing Marguerite in Faust. We're talking with Valerie Richelle, who's director for My Fair Lady, and with general director and founder of the opera, Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater, Michael Ballum. We're going to be taking a brief break here and back with more conversation and more music. We'll hear some music from Kiss Me, Kate, and from Faust, and some other music if we can fit it in. Before we go to break, we're talking about some distractions. You know, you go straight to the script before you go to other places. I got lost the other day on YouTube. It's just so easy to do.
You could spend your life there.
I pulled up Iliana Kotrubas, one of my favorite sopranos, and then that got me off into Romanian sopranos, and an hour and a half later, I'm, you know, so you got to be careful.
It's habit forming, isn't it?
Although it's great to be able to pull up these great singers of the past. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. We'll take a brief break and be back with members of the Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater. And here's some great music as well.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from the Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater, presenting performances of My Fair Lady, Tosca, Kiss Me Kate, and Faust, now through August 11th, celebrating their 20th season. More details at utahfestival.org.
Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. On the show this week, I feature the new collaboration from Stephanie Bettman and Luke Halpin, as well as the latest from the talented instrumentalist Jamie Bartschy. I'll also play songs from new discs by Sharon Goldman, The Pines, and Honor Finnegan, among other talented artists. Tune in and listen this Saturday at 8 p.m. to Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
Support for Utah Public Radio is also provided by Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. Tom Williams with you. And on this Friday, a special program coming to you from the Cache Valley Center for the Arts on Main Street in Logan, our downtown studios. And we are previewing seasons from a couple of great Utah arts organizations. Utah Shakespeare Festival will be coming up in about 10 or 15 minutes right now. Members of Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater, their season began on Wednesday, continues through August 11th. And the productions are Faust, Tosca, Kiss Me Kate, and My Fair Lady, and much else going on as well. Michael Ballum is the general director. Jessica Madoff is singing Marguerite in Faust, and Valerie Rochelle is the director for My Fair Lady. Michael, Eight Hands, Two Pianos was a production that that happens. Well, what else are the some of the extra things that people be enjoying?
Gershwin's landmark musical from 1930, Girl Crazy, that made a star of Ethel Merman, and then in 1943, when it was made into a motion picture, pushed Judy Garland into a higher realm of what she was able to express on screen. And we're doing a special tribute to Judy Garland. It is her 90th birthday. Wish she were around to enjoy it with us, but the music and the film clips that she left behind are here with us. Mm. So those two works are going to be very special, together with the St. Matthew Passion of Johann Sebastian Bach, a work that is seldom heard in its entire glory, and we would not be able to produce it were it not for the assistance of Craig Jessup, former conductor of the Tabernacle Choir, and his glorious American Festival Chorus. It will take 500 people to mount the St. Matthew Passion, and it's an opportunity that we seldom have to hear a work of that majesty. We're very grateful to be able to do that.
Tell me a little bit about Kiss Me Kate. This is one of the main. I hadn't remembered until I was reading some promotional material from the company. This is Cole Porter?
It is. Yes, Cole Porter in 1948. His crowning achievement, he was living at the Waldorf Astoria at the time, a little hotel there in New York. And they're so proud of the fact that he wrote Kiss Me Kate there that they have his piano on display in the lobby. It's a work that has caused us to grow. We were gearing towards Kiss Me Kate in our earlier years. We would hire opera singers and musical theater artists who could dance. But if you want to do Cole Porter's Kiss Me Kate, you have to have dancers who can sing. Mm-hmm. And we found some wonderful dancers, thanks to Valerie, because she's on the West Coast and knows so many of them. And it's just such a delight to see our what the opera world would call corps de ballet, Broadway calls them hoofers, out there making Cole Porter's music come to life, because he intended really extraordinary dancing and wrote some glorious dance sequences for this wonderful work. It's so charming, and it's very timely for today. The jokes are just as alive today as they were in 48. But this is a work that it's taken us 20 years to gain the resources to be able to comfortably put it on our stage.
And this is basically Taming of the Shrew.
It is. Within a play of a husband and wife acting team who have been divorced for a year. They can't live with each other, and they can't live without each other. And so we watch this wonderful development of their own personal lives through the crystal of William Shakespeare. It's delightful.
Valerie, tell us about the singing and dancing. Michael was saying you're looking for dancers who can sing. This must require some athleticism, some good breath control to be dancing and singing at that level.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I actually used to be, a college, you know, professor for a while, teaching movement to actors and things. And one of the things that we really, really encouraged was actually singing while on the treadmill. Because if you can't do a 3-minute dance break and then sing the end of the number, which is usually the biggest part of the number, the longest notes and the highest belting, then you're not going to be able to do your job. So that was,
very interesting.
Singing well on the treadmill. Is that something you're going to try now, Jessica? I don't know.
You bet. In high heels.
Let's hear a bit from this. This is one of the more famous numbers. These are some more minor characters. They're talking about the connection with Shakespeare. And
the two gangsters. This is the show-stopping 11 o'clock number.
Yeah, the 11 o'clock number. So let's hear this. Brush up on your Shakespeare.
Hey, who was that guy?
Who's this guy?
I don't know.
What?
Sing.
The girls today in society go for classical poetry.
So
to win their hearts, one must quote with ease Aeschylus and Euripides.
One must know Homer and, believe me, Paul,
Sophocles, also Sappho.
Unless you know Shelley
and Keats
and Pope,
dainty deafies will call you a dope.
But the poet of them all,
who will start him simply raven,
is the poet people call
the Bard of Stratford-on-Avon. Brush up your Shakespeare, start quoting him now. Brush up your Shakespeare, and the women you will wow.
Just declaim a few lines from Otello, and they'll think you're a hell of a fella.
If your blonde won't respond when you flatter her, tell her what Tony told Cleopatra.
If she fights when her clothes you are mussing,
why are clothes much ado about nothing? Brush up your Shakespeare, and they'll all bow, bow.
Brush up on your Shakespeare.
Cole Porter was so brilliant. He's one of the few composers who did both lyrics and music. There's only a handful of them, maybe six or seven out of thousands. And his lyrics are so clever. Every time I hear them, they never cloy. They never get tiresome. They're so clever and funny. And, of course, since he's writing the music, he sets the words so brilliantly to the tunes.
I'm thinking of some Cole Porter songs. One of them, Why Even the Janitor's Wife Has a Perfectly Good Love Life. You know, those phrases that he could just spin off. So Kiss Me, Kate, and that's basically Taming of the Shrew. Let's talk a bit about Faust. Tell us a little bit about your character, Marguerite. Of course, Faust is the classic story of the philosopher who sells his soul to the devil, basically for knowledge and youth, and he falls in love with Marguerite.
Yes, he does. Marguerite is essentially a very regular woman, well, not quite a woman. She's a young teenager when the opera begins, and leads a very normal life for the time, wherever it is chosen to be set. In our case, we're doing it in a very classical setting, but lives in a nice little country home, takes care of her garden. She, her mother has sadly passed away. Her sister, for whom Marguerite essentially cared for as her own, also died, which is a very tragic part of Marguerite's past. And her brother, Valentin, is a soldier, and he is heading off to war. So essentially, when we meet Marguerite, she is all but alone. And as the opera progresses, her brother dies as well. Not at war, but spoiler alert, I suppose. He does die. I won't say anything else. So she is essentially left alone, and also by Faust, because Faust comes in and woos her a bit and takes this very young, innocent, virginal woman and turns her into something that I don't think she ever wanted. She didn't choose. She was chosen, essentially, by Mephistopheles. And in the end, I think that Mephistopheles is using Faust to get Marguerite, because what's better than one soul but two to take home with you to the underworld? So it's
it's a complex character, I believe, that makes a beautiful arc. Mm. And by the end, she has changed so much. And although is in a very dire and sad situation, she is eventually saved and goes to heaven.
Yes, that's, and Mephistopheles' plans are foiled. Even though at the very end, it looks like he's going to be successful. Mm-hmm. He's not. That's the music we, in fact, we have queued up. So spoiler alert, as you say, this is the end of the opera. But as you say, Marguerite is eventually saved. And we hear this great organ music.
Yes.
This also always reminds me, Gounod, I think, had... maybe at one time wanted to be a priest. And he brings in this church music a lot in his operas. Of course, this is very appropriate at this point. So let's hear this. This is the finale of Faust. Hate to fade out of that, but I guess if you want to hear the rest of it, you have to come to the production here at Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater. I was wondering, Marguerite's gone through so much at this point, and what do you feel as a singer on stage when you hear that heavenly chorus?
Oftentimes I'm in tears. I love the dramatic aspect of singing, of being in the theater. So often I think singers are concentrate on the singing, and I feel like the acting is equally as important. So I have been through the ringer emotionally at this point, and that music is just so refreshing and just washes over you, and visually at this point in the show, which you will all come to see, it's so beautifully touching. All of the aspects of the drama, the music, the visual, it's just a very emotional time for
it's transcendent.
Myself and the audience, I think. Yeah.
It just lifts you to a higher plane, the triumph of the human spirit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting what Gounod and his librettists were able to do. This is a massive work of Goethe.
Yes.
He doesn't treat one of the parts, but it's fully.
Totality.
But,
mm-hmm. It's a challenging work to do today because the world doesn't believe the principle that... if you sow bad seeds, you'll reap a bad harvest. That behavior has consequence. And I went through a number of directors in conversations with them to see how they perceived that last moment. And many are uncomfortable with the idea that Faust does go to hell with Mephisto, as he promised the year before, and that she is saved because God sees into her heart and recognizes she was a victim of this and saves her. The Germans, when it was originally written, Goethe's original version didn't like that ending. They wanted somehow Faust to get off the hook, and I think that's not a true principle. I think every behavior we have has some kind of consequence, either for good or for evil. And so I had to go through a number of directors to come to one who agreed with what the final moment should be.
Mm. Well, we're out of time for this portion of the program. The main productions are Faust, Tosca, Kiss Me, Kate, and My Fair Lady. And we've been talking with general director of the company, Michael Ballum. Michael, by the way, this 20th anniversary.
Amazing.
Yeah, of a thousand. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And that's quite an accomplishment because many opera companies do fail early on.
We are the only opera company, musical theater company of the 90s that are still around to talk about it.
Mm. So thanks for coming in. Appreciate
Pleasure.
It. Valerie Rochelle, director of My Fair Lady. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Jessica Madoff, who's singing Marguerite and Faust. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a break with our Beehive Archive, and we'll be back to preview the season for another great art company in Utah, Utah Shakespeare Festival. That's coming up.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. Are you a bicycle commuter? Do you appreciate riding smooth roads on the way to work? This week, learn how cyclists fought to get Salt Lake City roads paved back in 1901. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
Salt Lake City is recognized nationally as a bicycle-friendly community, with more than 80 miles of cycle lanes and a bike commuter population that is four times the national average. But Salt Lake City was not always so accommodating to bicycle riders. In 1890, manufacturing advances made bicycles affordable to most Americans, and the freedom offered by this new contraption transformed both American lives and cities. Salt Lake City was caught up in the cycling craze that swept the country, with more than 2,500 bicycles filling city streets by 1896. By 1900, half of the city's 50,000 residents owned bicycles, with nearly every family harboring at least one. The bicycle had become a commuting necessity. But the growing number of urban cyclists conflicted with pedestrians over the use of sidewalks, where cyclists retreated when the unpaved dirt streets became muddy quagmires in the rain and snow. Laws restricting cyclists from sidewalks did not solve the problem of how to share public thoroughfares. While everyone agreed that the city should pave the streets, no one could agree on how to pay for it. Because of their unusual width, Salt Lake streets were costly to pave. Plus, the streetcar lobby, fearing a decline in ridership if roads were paved, convinced the state legislature to restrict Utah towns from paving more than 3 miles of road per year. Cyclists themselves were divided, with some arguing that bicycle license fees could pay for better infrastructure, while others argued they already paid taxes to maintain sidewalks and streets and objected to being double taxed. The debate dragged into the 20th century until frustrated cyclists got organized enough to influence municipal politics. In 1901, a group called the Wheelmen's Protective Association nominated its own candidates for city offices, and the political challenge was enough to compel some action. Cyclists compromised, agreeing to avoid banned sidewalks and pay a licensing fee, which forced Salt Lake City to finally start constructing paved roads and bike paths. Sources and past episodes of the Beehive Archive may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Support for Utah Public Radio is also provided by USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows.
Listening to Access Utah, I'm Tom Williams, and we are in our downtown studios on Main Street in Logan in the Cache Valley Center for the Arts. And now we're going to really brush up on our Shakespeare. We heard some music from Kiss Me, Kate earlier as we talked to members of Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater. We now bring in members of the Utah Shakespeare Festival. And we're going to be talking with Scott Phillips, Executive Director. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
We're also joined by Sarah Griffin, who is playing Anne Page in Merry Wives of Windsor in the ensemble in Les Miserables and Ophelia in Hamlet. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with you, Scott Phillips, executive director of the company. Utah Shakespeare Festival has been around some 50 years?
Yes, 51 years. So we've seen a lot of ups and downs, both in changes in Utah's demographics, economic tides, and boom and bust times. But we've weathered them all, and we're very happy to say that we're still here and thriving very well in southwestern Utah.
And, of course, the Tony Award in 2000, a highlight.
Absolutely. The Tony Award in 2000 sort of really helped set a benchmark for us and something that we don't take lightly. It's given with a great deal of scrutiny and people looking at your work. We're very honored to be recognized for that, and it just means that we continually worry to make sure that we keep the bar going higher and higher every year. And I think this year is no exception. We have six really diverse, interesting, and exciting productions. And for the first time in a number of years, we have three distinct green shows. We cut back on our green shows a few years ago because of the economy, but we've brought them back in their full swing again.
And so the productions were Shakespeare anyway, Merry Wives of Windsor, Titus Andronicus, Mary Stuart, Hamlet, and there are many other productions as well. I wonder, and I've been reading that, you know, there are Shakespeare festivals all across the country, in fact, around the world. What is it about Shakespeare?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and Sarah can certainly chime into this as a performer, but Shakespeare speaks so beautifully to the human condition. And I know that for 470-some years, what is still important to man, what still affects man, the consequences of people's actions, those haven't changed over the past five millennium or whatever, and we are still want to be loved, want to be cared about. We're still concerned with relationships. There's still struggle for power. There's still mistrust and deceit, and all of those things are explored in Shakespeare's plays so eloquently, and they still are very relevant today. There's no question about it.
Absolutely.
Sarah Griffin,
I totally agree with that.
You play many different kinds of roles.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
I was just going to comment and say that I completely agree with Scott, and it was very wonderfully put. And Shakespeare is one of my favorite things to do as an actress, just because the language is so great and beautiful and juicy, and it's so transcendent, and it's just wonderful, wonderful, wonderful material to sink your teeth into.
Tell us about the role of Ophelia in Hamlet.
I am thrilled to be playing that role. I actually got to meet with Danforth, who is going to be playing Hamlet in Chicago. It was great. We were both working there just before I came out here, and we got to meet and have our first little encounter and discussion about the play and what we think their relationship is and things like that. And actually, the director, Marco Baricelli, was in town for design meetings, and he very graciously let the cast come in, and we got to see early costume renderings and a mock-up of the set model. And so we got to be a part of the process much earlier than actors usually are, which was fantastic. And we've already had conversations about, you know, what we think is happening in this moment and what road we want to explore first and things like that, which is great because it kind of steers your preparation in a certain way, which helps you get to where you're going faster. And that's really, really exciting.
And sort of in a different vein, tell us about Anne Page in Merry Wives of Windsor.
Oh, I love Anne Page. She's so sweet. We did a lot of playing with raising my voice and physicality. I kind of jump around on my toes a lot. And she's a very sweet young woman coming into her own, you know, living in a society where she doesn't have a lot of say about who she gets to choose for a mate in life. And she handles it in a very fun way. And it's a joy to play her every time.
Tom, this is Scott
Phillips.
If I could,
yeah,
I just wanted to offer one point of clarification
yes.
early on. Mary Stuart, while it is about Elizabethan characters and political situations. It was actually written by Frederick Schiller, and then as we've adapted, we've taken an adaptation from Peter Oswald of this production. So it is about Elizabeth I. It is about Mary, Queen of Scots, and all the intrigue that went on between the two cousins. But it is not a Shakespeare play, even though we're doing it in the outdoor Adams Theater.
That's a good correction, I guess, because of its Elizabethan characters. I assumed it was Shakespeare.
Exactly.
The company does have a goal, I understand it, to perform all of Shakespeare's.
Yes. One of the things that the new artistic directors, David Ivers and Brian Vaughn, are wanting to do is an initiative they call Complete the Canon. All of the works of William Shakespeare. And we're beginning that with this year. With the three Shakespeare plays, one of Shakespeare's earliest plays, Titus Andronicus, which we're performing out of doors right now, The Merry Wives of Windsor, and then one of Shakespeare's much later and more mature plays with Hamlet. And that'll begin the cycle, and we hope within a 12-year period to be able to have completed all of them, and then people can sort of create, and we've helped them with some of our publications, a little checklist, if you will, to say, okay, I've seen that one, I've experienced that one, this is what I got from that one, and really try and build a following, plus also let people see the complete breadth of Shakespeare's work. And then as part of that, within that, with the history cycle, we are going to be doing all of the history plays in a chronological order, which allows people to get some of the history of England and all of the various monarchs. We've done most all of them, but not necessarily in the correct chronological order. And so we begin next year with King John. So it should be a real exciting trip for the next few years, watching all the plays as they unfold over the course of several years.
Tell us a bit about Scapin. It seems like an interesting production.
Well, Scapin itself, a play by Molière, again, which we have taken and done a modern adaptation of it, by Mark O'Donnell and Bill Irwin, and it's a very, very funny romp. It's just 2 hours of a lot of farcical slapstick. It's a typical story of servant-master kind of situations, mixed-up identities, trying to get the right girl to love the right boy, but it's all done in sort of a sense of 60s, I guess I would say. With, if you think of Laugh-In, there's doors that open, doors that shut, doors that slam into people, chases on stage. I tell my friends, if they come to see Scapin, they either want to sit right down front if they love to be involved in the play, and if they'd rather be observers of the play, to sit at the back, because this is very active and audience participatory kind of theater, with the lead role being played by David Ivers, who does an exceptional job as Scapin. And the whole cast is just strong in their whole commedia and farcical physicality of the play. It is definitely keep you wide awake, and there's a lot of music in it. It's almost, you would think it was a musical. There's so much music in it, but it's just a play with music.
Sarah Griffin, wonder if you tell us what it's like to be a performer there at the Utah Shakespeare Festival.
I can say without any flattery, it's one of the best jobs in the world. It is. This company is so well-rounded, and it is so cared for by all of the festival staff, administration, wardrobe, props, cost, I mean, everything. It is great to be a performer here. And there's lots of opportunities to interact with the audience as well. We have curtain call lunches. We have literary and actor seminars. Something that I do that I really enjoy are the backstage tours. It's a way I get to take people through my theater and show them what I get to do, you know, and I say, this is my makeup spot, and this is where I get excited about this, and this is where I do these kinds of things. And, you know, that moment in the play that you saw, this is where we're doing, you know, we're prepping for it or something. And just to be able to have that close relationship with our audience members, it's exhilarating. And we have teaching opportunities, which I'm exploring for the first time this year. It's wonderful. It's really, really great. We also have a program called REACH, which stands for Really Eager Artists Crying Hire, like, hire me, please. And it's a great organization that brings in casting directors and artistic directors from all over the country, because hopefully someday Utah will be year-round, but currently it is not, and we need to work when we are not here. And this is a totally volunteer driven organization run by the actors, and I have a big part in it this year. And it's just great to be at a festival and part of a company that has all of these wonderful offerings besides the great work that you get to do on stage. So without any chagrin or anything, I can say this is one of the best jobs in the world.
We just have a couple of minutes left. Mr. Phillips, what feedback do you get from your audience?
We are getting tremendous feedback from the audience. We have some of the most loyal fans around. I mean, they've got buttons they wear that say, this is my 20th year. I've been coming for 35 years. This is my 19th year. And we have these wonderful morning seminars every morning after the production out in a pine grove in a lovely setting. They get the opportunity to give feedback about the show they've seen the night before, the afternoon before. They ask questions about why did Shakespeare do this, or how come the playwright did this? Is this what the director's intent was? Or I like this, I didn't like this. You know, it's kind of a double-edged sword. They have very, very loyal audiences, and they're very intelligent about the work, but they have great ownership. And because of that ownership, they share their thoughts on the work. So it keeps us on edge, just trying to make sure that we come up to their expectations. And I'm happy to say with the plays and with the artists that David and Brian put together, I think we're meeting and exceeding those expectations. But it's really, our audiences are the reason we're here. It's that connection of theater. That's what makes theater live, is that thing that happens in the dark between an actor and an audience that creates an experience of a lifetime.
We're out of time. Scott Phillips, Executive Director of Utah Shakespeare Festival, and Sarah Griffin, acting in several roles, have been our guests. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
And we thank you for listening to Access Utah. We'll be coming to you from our downtown studios in Main Street, the Cache Valley Center for the Arts. And appreciate you listening. That's Access Utah for this Friday.
KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 Logan.